happy now. The color of the drug war in Texas. The U.S. Justice Department investigates. Congress today will decide whether to grant asylum to undocumented immigrants. Democrats and Republicans vie for the Latino vote. Also, are poor people being left behind? A look at welfare and the elections. And we hear comments from listeners around the country about their choice this November. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we go now to Tulia, Texas, where the Justice Department has opened a criminal investigation into whether civil rights were violated in a drug bust that has rounded up close to a third of the adult black population of the small Texas town. Randy Credico is with us from the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Randy.
Good morning, Amy and Juan.
Can you tell us what's happening?
Well, the Justice Department, based on a Title VI complaint by the NAACP and the ACLU that they filed last week, has officially opened a criminal investigation into through the Civil Rights Division into the entire operation that took place here, culminating last July 23rd, 1999, 43 people were arrested, and 40 were black in this drug sting. And so they're really looking into it now, and it's a welcome relief for the people in the city who were affected.
Well, Randy, the Swisher County District Attorney, Terry McEarkin, is quoted in the AP report as saying that he welcomes the Justice Department investigation, but he questions the timing less than 2 weeks from the presidential election. What's your response?
Well, that's what is to be expected. He's really under fire, not only for this case, but so many other cases. He did prosecute a man a couple of years ago that died in Texas's in Huntsville, lethal chamber there, by the name of Stoker, who was looks like he was innocent. He has a real bad history, Mr. McEachern, and, he's just trying to deflect attention from the truth. Larry Stewart, the sheriff of Swisher County, will say the same thing, that this is politically motivated. The fact of the matter is it's a little too late. You know, we wish this had happened a month ago. But we're glad that it's happening right now.
And what about the national attention to Tulia? Of course, here on Democracy Now! And WBI in New York, we've been reporting on it for months, and then there was finally a front page editorial in New York, a news story in the New York Times. What's the press coverage like these days down there?
Well, the press coverage is still, very heavy here, but a lot of the major networks are waiting until after the election to run their stories, I have found out, which, to not affect the election. This is an election issue. They should be paying attention. We thank goodness for Democracy Now! And WBAI in New York for uncovering. Actually, it was the Texas Observer that did a story, 4 or 5 months ago, but it was buried. But Democracy Now! And WBAI did a few stories on it, 3 or 4 stories, and now the press has followed. It's a huge story. Newsweek is going to run something on Monday, but the Time magazine has, put theirs on the table until after the election. But there's a lot of local coverage, and there is a lot of national coverage, but some of the big guns are waiting until after the election, unfortunately, as if this is not an election issue.
We're talking to Randy Kunstler of the William...
Randy
Credico of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. The national media, since we do a lot of middle media criticism, Randy, what difference does it make in a case like this? And would you say overall that it did spur the national investigation?
Well, I think so. Like I said, it started there, and they had to follow suit. It's a real heavy story here. And without the national media getting involved, finally, this wouldn't have happened. New York Times, L.A. Times, they came in on it weeks after you did. That definitely did prompt an investigation. there has to be an investigation of the entire state of Texas. As far as I'm concerned, they ought to quarantine it because this is happening all over the state. There are 190,000 people in prison. Half of those people are in here for nonviolent drug offenses. One out of every 14 black men are in prison. One out of every 170 white men are in prison. It's just, I mean, this is a slave state that's happening right now. I mean, the debt that Randall Robinson was talking about earlier on WBAI is increasing because these people are in prison, they're working for corporations, and they're building two new prisons in the city near Tulia, one in Tulia. They're going to build a new prison. They're going to spend $500 million on two new prisons as if we don't have enough in the state right now. I feel like I'm a resident. Actually, I am a resident of the Tulia branch of the NAACP, which opened up last week, which has caused a furor here.
Randy Credico, thanks for being with us of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
Good day, Amy, and to all of our listeners. And I'm sure that people around the country are glad to know that the World Series, the New York World Series, is over and that at least there'll be a little bit more space, allegedly, for news events that are occurring, not just sports around the country in these next few days.
Well, Juan, it's very interesting to note that the networks are talking about the issue of free airtime right now. Apparently, PBS, that's public broadcasting, has offered free airtime to presidential candidates beginning October 25th and concluding Friday, November 3rd, just before the election the following Tuesday. The candidates will get 2.5 minutes at the end of the news hour with Jim Lehrer to address viewers directly. And don't forget, Jim Lehrer was the moderator of the three presidential debates that were sponsored by the Commission on Private the Commission on Presidential Debates, sponsored by private corporations like Anheuser-Busch. But interestingly enough, in the tradition of that Commission on Private Debates, PBS has not opened the forum, the offer of free airtime, to all the candidates, only to Al Gore, four nights for Al Gore, and four nights for George W. Bush, even though, if you count the days between now and the election, there would be time for all the major presidential candidates, including major third-party candidates. So PBS has basically endorsed the exclusionary policy of the Commission on Presidential Debates, which was started by the Republican and the Democratic Party.
Well, Amy, I don't see why you're surprised, given the fact that Lehrer was the host. I'm sure he had a lot to say with the commission in deciding the debate format. And I'm sure that if he chose or if PBS chose at this hour to actually provide full exposure to all the candidates, it'd be the last time that Jim Lehrer or PBS would be hosting any presidential debates. So it's no surprise. It's just a continuation, I think, of the same policy of limiting the debate among the American people as to presidential candidates.
And of course, the exclusionary policy is not only on the part of led by the commission, which set the bar at 15% in five national polls before the debates began. which was clearly very arbitrary. It was not based on anything that they'd even done before. In fact, in 1992, Ross Perot would not have been able to be a part of the debate if that bar had held then. It's not only the policy of PBS, though, and the CPD. I mean, the New York Times yesterday came out in the second scathing editorial about Ralph Nader continuing to run, saying Mr. Nader's electoral mischief. You also did a column on Nader yesterday in the New York Daily News, Juan.
Yes, well, this is actually the fourth editorial that the New York Times has had since June criticizing Nader as a candidate. There, I think there's almost as many editorials against him as there's been news stories about his campaign in the political sections of the paper. Yes, and the Times was unusually, shall we say, emotional in their attack this time. I mean, I wonder what happened to the usual decorum of the Times. They used words in this editorial: we would regard Mr. Nader's willful prankishness as a disservice to the electorate, no matter whose campaign he was hurting. And later on, they said he calls his wrecking ball candidacy a matter of principle, but it looks from here like ego run amok. Not the type of words that the Times usually
uses for a presidential candidate.
For presidential candidates.
Gosh,
yes.
I thought it was called practicing democracy. This morning, early in the morning, I was watching CNN, and there was Al Gore saying something about some issue. There was George Bush, a quote about some issue that he is focusing on. Then there was a photograph of Nader. I thought, oh, and then we're going to see what Nader has to say about some issue. Maybe, amazingly enough, it would be about corporate crime, one of the issues he harps on. But instead, it was simply about Nader in relation to Gore. In fact, it was the first time I saw Gore say Nader's name, Ralph Nader, because, of course, they've been trying to ignore him, better left unsaid than even mention him. But because he's become such a threat in what they're calling the battleground states or the swing states, they are now starting to, well, go after him in a big way, as we saw yesterday on Democracy Now! When we brought you what has become a team of what they're calling Nader's Raiders now for Gore. But in the New York Times yesterday also was an op-ed piece, by Barbara Ehrenreich, who we also had on yesterday, a third-party mainstream hopes, as it was headlined, and she was talking about why she supported Ralph Nader. Well, the politics continues, and we're going to talk about issues today that are part of the electoral race and sometimes not mention the electoral campaign, but also issues that are being raised in Congress, because, yes, Congress does plod along as the election is going on. It's headed for an end-of-session confrontation with President Clinton over opposing immigration measures. President Clinton has called for amnesty for all illegal immigrants who arrived before 1986, among other measures that help immigrants. Republicans blasted the proposed legislation as a ploy to grab Latino votes November 7th, while saying it would also lead to a surge in illegal immigration. Republicans instead put forward their own proposals for immigrants that Clinton has threatened to veto, saying they're not broad enough and leave out some of the measures he proposed to help immigrants. The Republican measures are part of a close to $40 billion spending bill for the Departments of Commerce, Justice, and State, and a tax package, both of which were approved in the House yesterday, but fell short of the two-thirds majority needed to reverse a presidential veto. Republican leaders hope to push both measures through the Senate today. These are two of the last bills needed to complete the overdue fiscal 2001 budget.
Well, during the past decade, more immigrants have come to the United States than at any time in American history. However, immigration issues have been largely unaddressed in the campaigning of both George W. Bush and Al Gore. There were no questions, for instance, in any of the presidential debates about immigration, unlike last election, when there was much discussion of immigration. Yet the candidates are courting the immigrant vote, specifically the Latino vote, and they have done so using Spanish ads and snatches of learned Spanish and even mariachi bands. So as Clinton throws his last vote for the amnesty of undocumented immigrants, we're going to take a look at some of the issues of immigration that the debates ignored.
That's right. Although I have to say, Pat Buchanan is not ignoring them. In his latest campaign ad, he has a picture of immigrants coming over the border. And of course, the way it is cast is as a threat to the people of this country. But right now, we're joined by two people. Marcela Garcia is the executive director of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. And Dagoberto Vega is Al Gore's liaison to the Latino community. Let's start with Dagoberta Vega. Can you explain what is being put forward and battled over in Congress right now?
Sure. And before I do that, I want to say good morning here to all, both of you. Thank you for having me on. Since the very beginning, Vice President Al Gore has supported the legislation S-2912, the Latino and Immigrant Fairness Act, and he continues to support it in Congress and has commended the efforts of both the President and the Democrats to stand firm against the Republican efforts to block it. As you have mentioned, the bill itself does three basic things which affect both the equal treatment of immigrants and promotes the family reunification. And all of these three provisions, which are very important to the Latino community, have not been either not been addressed by Governor Bush at all, or has he flat out opposes. The first one concerns NACARA parity, which is refers to the Nicaraguan Adjustment and Central American Relief Act, which allows certain immigrants to that have been treated differently in the past to have equitable treatment with these are particular immigrants who fled human rights abuses or unstable conditions in their home countries. There's a second part regarding limited amnesty, which, as you've mentioned.
And if I can ask you there, how many immigrants, you were talking now about basically Salvadoran, Honduran, Guatemalan, Liberian, and Haitians, right, immigrants in this country, but how many are affected?
Oh, I don't have that number off the top of my fingertips. I think the main idea is that these it would eliminate the differences and allow those immigrants to be eligible for permanent resident status adjustment if they meet the same requirements as previous immigrants that have fled for the same reasons, such as Nicaraguans. I don't have that number specifically, but it's been a very big concern for especially the newer immigrants in this country, new citizens and people who have been here a while. And I mean, obviously, it affects family members, and I think that's why you have immigrant groups like LULAC, Naleo, La Raza, all, and obviously the members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus from the very beginning, believing that this is an important measure. But if I continue, the other two measures should be also noted. You already mentioned late amnesty, which allows the movement of the registry date to 1986, allowing immigrants to become lawful residents. And the final one was the 245i provision, which is basically allowing immigrants eligible for residency to have their papers processed in the U.S. rather than go back to their home country. And this is basically supporting family reunification. And I think in each and every one of these measures, Governor Bush has not had any way to back up his rhetoric. He's never, you know, he often talks about how our values should be extended beyond the Rio Grande River. But I think in this election, he has yet to back that rhetoric up with concrete proposals, with this opportunity to support this legislation that I think most Latino organizations, nonpartisan, non-for-profit organizations, believe is important.
Maricela Garcia of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, how have, do you feel, from your perspective, immigrants fared under the Clinton-Gore administration? Maricela?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I couldn't hear the question very well. Can you repeat it?
How have immigrants fared under the Clinton administration?
Well, I think that, unfortunately, we saw the signing in 1996 of IRA-IRA as a very sad piece of history in the relationship of the Clinton administration with immigrants.
IRA-IRA? What is that?
IRA-IRA is the Welfare Reform and Immigration Reform. And that reform created many obstacles for immigrants to reunify with their families. There were elimination of access to key benefits for immigrants. Throughout the years after the law was signed, the administration has made significant efforts to restore SSI and impartial restoration of food stamps. And we have seen also this year, the year of elections, an enormous commitment from the administration to restore to restore some of the benefits, specifically in relation to health insurance for children, expanding health insurance for children, and also for expansion of food stamps. Nothing has passed yet, but we have been very glad to see that there has been commitment from the administration, not only for the LIFA bills that they were mentioned before, NACARA 245I, and also the moving the registry date to 1986, but also those other pieces of restoration of benefits. And so that's in the inventory of how since 1996, when unfortunately the administration signed on that law, the changes that have taken place. And we hope that this year of election is going to be matched by a full commitment from the administration to seriously veto any immigration measures that don't include those bills that we spoke about.
Maricela Garcia and Dagoberta Vega, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. Maricela Garcia is Executive Director of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Dagoberta Vega is Al Gore's liaison to the Latino community. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue on the issue of immigration in this election year, our guests are Dagoberta Vega, Al Gore's liaison to the Latino community, and Maricela Garcia, executive director of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Juan?
Yeah, I'd like to return to Maricela Garcia. For most of our listeners who are not familiar with the Byzantine world of immigration law, there are about a million people in this country who would be affected by the proposed change one way or another. According to the administration, they're in favor of legalizing all million people, whereas the Republican measure would only legalize the situation for about 300,000 to 400,000. Is that accurate? And could you talk a little bit about what are the inequities and how the Republicans, at least in Congress, have dealt with this immigration normalization issue?
Yes, you're accurate that those three measures under LIFA will give the opportunity to about 1 million immigrants to obtain their legal status. And in terms of how the Republicans have, what support we have seen Republicans have in relation to these three issues, it's very unfortunate that we have not seen that support at all. And it's interesting that we hear mariachi bands and an effort to reach out to the Latino community with a large number of immigrants. And everyone is aware about the increased number of immigrants that have naturalized in 1996. And yet, the Republicans in Congress have not understood the importance of delivering some of these basic bills that will make a difference in how immigrants will be voting in the upcoming elections. And unfortunately, the support has been very, very little from the Republican Party. In fact, there has been a lot of opposition to these three bills.
Now, as I understand it, the Congress agreed to provide some degree of access to normalization of status for Nicaraguans and for Cubans who came in the 90s, but not for Salvadorans, Guatemalans, Hondurans. What was the basis for that decision?
Well, the basis, in the analysis that we make is that it has to do again with the political relationship that was established in the 80s with Central America and Cuba, that unfortunately foreign policy does have an impact in domestic policy. And since the very beginning, our government preferred the relationship with the government of Nicaragua, with the people of Nicaragua and Cuba, and did not recognize that refugees or people fleeing Guatemala and El Salvador were fleeing because of the similar circumstances. So that, again, was clear in how these the NACARA preferences were given to those sectors because of the relationship with those governments. And for many years, as you might remember, the U.S. government denied the support that it was given to the Salvadorian and Guatemalan government to repress the people of those countries until President Clinton went to Guatemala and Central America 2 years ago and admitted that those policies had been wrong. But unfortunately, that recognition was not carried in allowing the legal status to Guatemalans and Salvadorians. So that, again, summarizing, has to do with foreign policy and the political relation that the United States had with those countries.
And the efforts to get Governor Bush from Texas to take a stand on this, why has his campaign or he refused at this so far to take positions on these issues?
You know, that is very interesting that coming from a state with large number of immigrants that the candidate Bush is not taking seriously the importance of broadening his agenda on immigration issues. And so far, we have seen that he's only addressing issues of citizenship backlog, restructuring the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and in support for temporary agricultural workers visas as well as H-1B visas. And that is not a comprehensive agenda on immigration at all. So it's contradictory that to try to reach out to a group of voters without addressing comprehensively or taking a position on those issues that are meaningful to those voters.
And Dagoberta Vega, in terms of the of Al Gore, you're his liaison in the Latino community. Gore has been pretty vocal in terms of the H-1B issue, but even though you're saying he backs the president on this bill, we haven't heard too much in any of the debates or in many of his speeches about immigration.
I have to disagree. I think obviously at the debates we had no opportunity to bring up the issue, since the questions were either brought up by the regular citizens in the last debate or by Lara himself. So that's something, you know, a form that he can provide this information. And he has spoken about this in many speeches, especially in audiences that particularly care about this issue. Whenever he has spoken to, Latino communities, or every time he has an opportunity, every time he speaks to Spanish language media, Maria Elena Colina Salinas from Univision, every opportunity talks to him about this. And in fact, I advise your listeners, those who are big Univision fans, to tune in the Saturday before the elections. Gore will be on the famed show Sábado Gigante with Don Francisco. And on that show, Don Francisco actively, you know, asks this question, talks about immigration, and the vice president is not afraid to go over not just the law but the human impact of these laws. And I think he has a true understanding of immigration policy beyond INS reform, beyond H-1B. I think he has consistently been on this issue. I mean, we realize that we're the Latino community. Their concerns, their top concerns, are similar to the top concerns of the rest of the country when it comes to educating our children, providing more health care insurance. But immigration is also an important issue. And I think it's only been our campaign, Gore's campaign, that's recognized that in the course of this election.
Well, we want to thank you both very much for being with us as we move on with another issue during Democracy Now! Today in this election year, covered and uncovered, and has to do with welfare. Dagoberta Vega, Al Gore's liaison to the Latino community, and Maricela Garcia, executive director of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Last week, Maximus and Goodwill, the two largest W-2 welfare agencies in Milwaukee, admitted to improperly spending hundreds of thousands of welfare dollars on projects in other states, parties, promotional schemes, meals, and concerts. Maximus admits to inappropriately billing the state $411,000, while the legislative joint audit found an additional $1.6 million that wasn't well documented. Goodwill, which is still under investigation, admits to spending $143,000 on travel, meals, housing, and salaries in Arizona to secure a welfare contract there. To date, there's no move to terminate either corporation's current or future W-2 contracts, nor has the DA filed criminal charges against either agency. This comes as the gap between the rich and poor is the largest it's ever been in the history of this country. And as the candidates continuously refer to the booming economy, the poor are increasing daily. The net financial wealth of the top 1% of American households now equals the combined wealth of the bottom 95% of households. And in the current presidential campaign, welfare is an issue that has received little attention. We're joined right now by Michael Zeldin, who is a former independent counsel and a spokesperson for the Gore campaign. And in the studio with us is Taina Gonzalez, who is a Puerto Rican single mother and intern at the Brooklyn-based community organization Make the Road While Walking. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, I'd like to begin with Michael Zeldin. We just had some guests talking about immigration, and there was some criticism from Maricela Garcia, the executive director of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, about the Clinton administration's support back in 96, both of the manner of welfare reform that was implemented as well as of the immigration laws. And although she noted that the administration has sought to change some of the worst aspects of that welfare reform law, like the SSI cutoffs. But what is your sense of how well welfare reform has been implemented across the country since 96?
Well, I think that 96 was a particularly difficult time for everybody of conscience. It was a difficult act, the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, and I think it all made us swallow hard at some point. But I think that the success of the program, notwithstanding this painful birth, has been profound if you measure it in terms of numbers of people that have left the welfare rolls for work, numbers of businesses that have been started, rates of interest that people have been able to get small businesses up and running, the improvements in 98, 99, 2000 to sort of cut the harshness off of some of that 1996 act through administrative regulation. So I think that while born of a tough time, if the measure is how many more people are working today than were then, we see that the welfare rolls have since that time shrunk by nearly 56%. We have the highest employment that we've had in since the early 1960s, and I think that that's good. I think we've got a lot more to do. The gap between the rich and poor has to be closed, which is why the vice president has been so dogged on this point of the Bush tax cut and trying to focus tax policy in a way that is more beneficial, earned income tax credits and block grants and other things that are more needed than tax relief for the wealthiest 1% of the population. So I think we're making progress. We always have a long way to go. If one child is hungry and or one person is on welfare, then it's a mark of a not less than perfect society, which is where we are all striving to be.
Well, I'd like to bring in Taina Gonzalez, who is one of the people affected by that welfare reform. And if you could tell us a little bit about your experience over the past few years.
First, I would like to say that it isn't just one person or one family that's going through hunger. All right. It's a lot of families. It's a lot of persons. And as Mr. Michael Belden said, that there's all these people working. Do you have documented proof saying that these people are working? Just because they're not on welfare doesn't mean that they're not working. There's a lot of people that I've seen with my own eyes who are in the centers every day trying to get help. But all they get is discrimination. All they get is pushed aside. All they get is mistreated. So for you, Mr. Velden, to say that, well, things are looking up and looking better, I suggest that you take a walk down to your local welfare center and you see how people are being treated there. Okay, people are not being treated nicely. All right, they're not getting the help that they need. They're not getting the food that they need for their family. You know, they're not getting jobs. What they're getting is slavery. Okay, and it's not right. It's a harsh world. This is true. Okay, but it's not. I thought slavery was over like 100 years ago. With this new welfare deform, as I like to call it, the slavery comes back.
In what ways?
In what ways? First of all, they force you to work, whether you're cleaning the street or cleaning up their file system. Well, over here in New York anyway. Instead of giving you the help that you need to get up on your feet, okay, and probably get an education so you can become something professional. They put you in these wet programs where you're cleaning the street for less than minimum wage, okay? And they force you to clean these streets because they tell you, if you don't go clean these streets or if you don't do this program or if you don't do this, we're going to cut your benefits off. And that affects the children because I don't know anybody who doesn't have kids who's on welfare.
Well, Michael Zeldin, what about this whole issue of how the welfare-to-work programs in many areas, governments have resorted to using people basically below minimum wage in jobs? And what about the requirements? Doesn't the welfare reform legislation require a 5-year cutoff for anybody who has been who is on welfare? And aren't we about to enter that period when we're really going to see the impact of this reform?
Well, a couple of things. First, with respect to the treatment that people may receive in an individual welfare office, I obviously can't remark on it personally. All I can say is it's not acceptable. It's clearly not administration policy to treat people with anything less than full dignity. We do not support below minimum wage employment. In fact, we have been pushing hard for an increase in the minimum wage and instructive, I think, perhaps on the whole issue as we try to answer the broad question of what should we do in this upcoming election cycle? Should we vote for Vice President Gore to continue to improve this system, or should we turn toward Governor Bush or for that matter, any other third-party candidate, Ralph Nader, perhaps specifically. I think that the most telling thing is this present debate that's going on this so-called tax relief bill, the one that Clinton has today threatened to veto, this bill will not permit, notwithstanding the administration's desire to have it, the expansions of Medicaid for low-income pregnant women and children who were ineligible under current law because of their immigration status, for working parents with severely disabled children to try to deal with this impending deadline on this welfare-to-work requirement. All of this stuff has been cut out of the bill by the Republican Congress in favor of subsidies for business meal deductions, $25 billion over 10 years to increase the business meal deduction. And so in some sense, I mean, I sort of feel that we're arguing among friends, that we all agree here that there are improvements that need to be made, that it's educational opportunities, child support, transportation, affordable housing are all goals that we share, and getting there is something that we all strive to do. We have to deal with the reality of a Republican-controlled Congress and the very real prospect that Governor Bush, if he becomes president, will do nothing but set back the agenda that we all have. So,
and
yes, there are problems. Nobody who is speaking honestly can deny that.
But if Gore becomes president, you're saying that none of this is going to happen, that the Republicans aren't going to have a say? When you just said just now that the reason that so much benefits were cut off, it was because the Republicans cut it off. But wasn't it the Gore and Clinton administrative that passed the law with all the cutoffs?
Well, before we get into that, we do have to break for stations around the country to take a 1 minute break to do their own identification. So we will be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! We're talking with Michael Zeldin, a former independent counsel and spokesperson for the Gore campaign, and Taina Gonzalez, a single mother here in New York and part of a community organization called Make the Road While Walking. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez with Amy Goodman, and we're talking with Michael Zeldin, a former independent counsel and spokesman for the Gore campaign, Taina Gonzalez, a member of Make the Road by Walking, a Brooklyn community organization, and the subject is welfare reform and welfare issues in this presidential year. Now, Taina, you were raising some criticisms of Michael Zeldin's viewpoint questioning whether the Clinton and Gore administration's original support of welfare reform, along with the Republicans, has not created the problem that you and others find yourselves in now. Could you expand on that before we go to Zeldin?
The problems that we find ourselves in now is that, all right, they want us to work. The welfare system wants us to work. And I could understand that, all right? But then they won't give us child care money for working, even though they say we provide child care money. They don't give it. All right, so we have to watch our children and we have to go to work. We are being discriminated against left and right, even though we made a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights a year and a half ago. They still haven't answered our complaint. The complaint was for translation within the welfare centers. we are constantly being discriminated against, and you come out and you say, well, we're going to make things better for everyone or the poor people, but in reality, you could have made things better just by not passing the bill. You know, you could have made sure that there was corrections on the bill. Well, okay, we will give this and we will give that. But the Gore and Clinton administration never did. All right. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, we're going to fix that now. It's like 4 years too late. You can't just fix it. And I want to know what you think about it.
Well, you're correct to say that the 1996 bill was a bipartisan bill, that it was supported by the administration, and that, as I said at the outset, there was some pain undeniably associated with that. There was a change, a sea change in 1996 with respect to the sort of overview of welfare and work requirements. But I think a couple of things are important. First, as I said at the outset, welfare, the number of people on welfare has gone down significantly.
There and where are those more people are at
there
now?
There are more people working now.
Where?
Across the country. And there are 1.1 million jobs hired through the Welfare to Work partnership with private businesses. There are 50,000 federal new jobs that have been provided. People are working in record numbers in minority communities, small business ownership is up, housing is up.
If I can interrupt for 1 second, how many of those people who are working would have been working anyway as a result of the expansion of the economy, and how many are actually being put into the economy as Diana Gonzalez says, below minimum wage now as a result of welfare reform and, in essence, creating a poor people's subsidy for lots of local governments around the country?
Well, two things. One is I don't have the ability to calculate what number of people would be working because of the good economy versus the change in the welfare roles. My view is that in either case, credit is due to the current administration, both for the economic climate we find ourselves in, if that's what's been the cause of the benefit to the working poor or former welfare recipients, or because of the change of the act, which has asked and allowed people to go back to work while providing child care, health care, transportation, subsidized housing, all of the components of the program. There is always room for improvement. As I said, you just need to look only to the current tax bill to see how we've tried to expand the Medicaid for certain classes of immigrants and to working parents with severely disabled children to find the Republican Congress not including that in the bill. It is a very difficult environment within which to legislate when the Republicans control the House, and they control the Senate. And so you do as best you're able to do. We have doubled the number of parents that are eligible for child care. We have increased and expanded Head Start. We have increased EITC benefits. We have increased the amount
That's
of
the,
money.
That's the earned income tax credit.
Right. Mm-hmm. We have increased the subsidies for housing and transportation. We are working hard to reduce teen pregnancy. These are all of the issues that the administration has been committed to over the last 8 years. It would be wrong for me to say that problems don't still exist. It would be wrong to say that if people are working at a below minimum wage and are therefore sort of in somehow sort of forced into work under unlivable working conditions, that's not acceptable. That's not what we strive for. And as I said, we are being held hostage in this budget cycle because we have been promoting the increase in the minimum wage, and the Republicans think, well, because we need that and want that so badly.
Okay, if I can interrupt you for one second, let me get Taina Gonzalez in here. And in terms of the issues that he raised, that in essence the Clinton administration it does not have a free hand, that it has to deal with the Republican-controlled Congress, and it's trying to do the best it can within those limitations. What's your response?
Well, my response is that from what I know, the president is the president, the vice president is the vice president, and it's their signature that makes laws or doesn't make laws. They put their signature down. So they knew that things were going to happen. They knew that by giving the state and local governments control over welfare, they knew that things were going to happen. Over here in New York, there's 600,000 people who are no longer on welfare, and that's considered a success, all right? But here's a question. Where are those 600,000 people? Because they won't tell us, well, they're working or, all right, they're doing this or they're doing that. That's like the EMS, the Emergency Medical Service, telling us, oh, we saved 600,000 less lives. What happened to those 600,000? You understand? By you telling me that, well, the Republicans have control, you're not telling me anything. You're just telling me that you're weak and that you buckle down under pressure. And for me to sit back here and say, oh, well, Bush is bad, but Gore is less bad, well, I'm going to vote for Gore, I would have to be totally stupid, you know? I have to find somebody who's not worse than Bush and not worse than Gore. I have to find somebody else, because you give me two bad choices and expect me to pick the less worse than the two. I mean, that's wrong.
We have fundamentally different politics, you and I. My view is that in presidential election cycles, or in any election cycle, when you have only two candidates who will likely be elected, you always vote for the person who is going to be more empowering to the issues that matter to you. That votes of conscience, so-called, are the, sort of the luxury of the elite. They are not practically born, and they do not, in the long or the short run, help the political causes that you and I value. So we differ that way. My dad...
So basically what you're telling me is...
No, let me finish with that. My dad used to vote... for Barry Commoner. I think he voted one year for Eldridge Cleaver. All my life I went to happy birthday Norman Thomas, sort of Socialist Workers Party stuff. Well, I used to volunteer down there at BAI in New York. And we had this debate all the time. And I used to ask him in his later years, do we think the country was better off having had Richard Nixon as president than we would have been better off having had Hubert Humphrey, because he wouldn't vote for Humphrey because he viewed them as a twiddly D and dumb proposition. My view is, looking back and at the time, was that we all would have been a lot better off with Hubert Humphrey than we were with Richard Nixon. And so fundamentally, when you ask the question of what should a person do in this election cycle, and you see candidates who have marked different viewpoints, that is, between Governor Bush and Al Gore.
Sheldon, we're running out of time, if you can wrap it up. Yeah.
Then there is only the choice for Al Gore. And if you actually go to the web pages of Ralph Nader and Al Gore, you will be very hard-pressed to find a difference between the two of them as a matter of philosophy. So, with respect to these issues.
Okay, well, we only have a little bit of time. Taina Gonzalez, your last comments?
Okay, well, with regards of going to the webpage of Al Gore and Ralph Nader, from what I've seen the Clinton and Gore administration do, and even though Gore wasn't the president at the time, he was a part of the administration, they took a lot of support from poor families. They put a lot of hurting on a lot of people who are poor. Okay, and I can't forgive what they've done, all right? And, okay, Ralph Nader, he may not have the money to put his big ads on television or whatever and whatnot, but I know that he's over here trying to make the world a better place. And I'm not going to go and vote for Gore because he's the better of the two. It's not right. No, I got to vote for Nader. Okay, because at least I know that he's trying to make a difference. And I'm not going to vote for Gore because, well, you say, well, we buckle down under the pressure.
Well, the
Well, I think on that note, we're going to have to wrap up this this debate. I want to thank both Michael Zeldin, a former independent counsel and spokesman for the Gore campaign, and Taina Gonzalez, a single mother and a member of Make the Road by Walking, a community organization in Brooklyn. Now we're going to switch to some listener comments. We've been asking you to give us your comments. Yesterday we asked all of you around the country to call into our comment line and tell us what questions you would ask the presidential candidates and who you would vote for and why. We were flooded with calls, and we're going to bring some of them to you right now.
Yes, good morning. My name is Althea Waits. I'm calling from Los Angeles. I listen to KPFK, and my question for George Bush would be to give a little more clarification to the Social Security issue and also to issues regarding foreign policy, which I really don't think he is qualified to handle. I am a Gore supporter, and that would be my question for George Bush.
This is Jim Ranish. I live in New Jersey, listening to WBAI 99.5 FM. I want to make a point about Nader. One of the things that in the Green Party has been saying is that particularly in the state that one of the candidates is already a sure winner, either Gore or Bush, then those states are the best ones to encourage people to vote for Nader. In the swing states, where they're about evenly divided, then consider voting for Gore. Thank you.
Yes, this is James from Manhattan. It is my intention to vote for Ralph Nader on the rationale that the only way to cast a vote is to cast it honestly and on the basis of meritorious service, and neither of the other candidates has a record of in excess of 3 decades of bringing home issues that have saved lives, as Ralph Nader has done in consumer protection. My question for both Al Gore and George Bush is, when are you going to stop lying to the public? When are you going to concede that there's a corporate stranglehold on every decision that you make, and whether you have the courage to come out and give America, the United States of America, back its liberty and the pursuit of democracy? Thank you.
Hi, it's Patty Tesler calling from Orange County, New York. I listen to WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York. It looks like I'll be voting for Nader. I'll do what I have to do to make sure that Bush isn't elected, but I don't think that my voting for Nader in New York State is going to endanger Gore's ability to get elected. The interesting thing is that the local Democratic Party called me up doing a survey and asked who would I be voting for, Gore, Bush, or undecided, and I said, well, are those the only choices? And I guess not. I guess there's the da-da-da-da, and they started listing them off. I said, well, I'll be voting for Nader. And she paused and said, well, I only have these 3 choices. I guess I'll have to put you down as undecided. I thought that was very interesting. Okay, I'm really enjoying listening to you. I can't even tell you how much. Thanks so much for the show.
This is Oswald Sykes in Albany, New York. I listen to WRPI Troy, New York. I'm calling in relation to the question of who I'd be voting for. I'm voting for Ralph Nader. His integrity is above all others, and I think it's time that the Democrats need to learn a lesson.
Well, those are some of the comments that we've been getting, and we urge you to keep calling, and we'll air as many responses as we can get during the week. The number is 212-209-2999. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jillian Aldrich and Sidrock Franklin. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Our engineer is Matthew Finch. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Juan Gonzalez with Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!